This is Central Time. I'm Rob Ferret. Polling from the Associated Press has found that nearly half of Americans, 47%, don't want to see a Trump-Biden rematch in 2024. Only 4% said they'd like to see both politicians run again. The rematch is looking like a real possibility in spite of Trump's legal troubles and Biden's not great approval rating. It is still early. A lot could change, but we're getting a preview now of the campaign and that possibility of a Trump-Biden rematch in 2024. You can join in at 800-642-1234. When I say the phrase Trump versus Biden 2024, how does that make you feel? Is there another candidate or type of candidate you'd like to see step up on one side or the other? And what issue is most important to you in the campaign? Or did you lunge to turn the radio off the moment I started talking about the presidential race? Call in now at 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234 or email ideas@WPR.org. Susan Johnson is an associate professor of political science and associate dean in the College of Letters and Sciences at UW-Whitewater. Susan, welcome back to Central Time.
Thanks, Rob. I'm glad to be back.
Well, hammer a point home again. It is, you know, April of 2023. A lot can change between now and 2024. That said, it looks like the possibility of President Biden running for re-election as a Democrat is, he's likely to be the candidate. Donald Trump seems to be the front runner on the Republican side. How big a possibility do you see this being?
I mean, barring something tragic, I would say, we would expect to see Joe Biden as the nominee. There's no challenger yet to date. There are challengers to date, but none that would be considered serious challenges. I think that most people feel that where we are right now, again, in April of 23, that former President Trump has a pretty good path toward the nomination. But, you know, it's so hard to know what might happen. There's all of these investigations, other legal issues. There's the potential for a challenger to catch fire, although we're not seeing that. So it's looking to be like a rematch.
The precedent for a former president, leaving office for whatever reason, coming back and running again, that's only happened a handful of times. Only once has it been ultimately successful, and that's, 150 years ago or so. We've never seen this in our lifetime. Susan, what do you make of that possibility of a former president being on a major party ticket?
Well, I mean, I think that nothing is unexpected to me when we're talking about former President Trump. So most presidents, when they lose their re-election campaigns, they tend to realize that the voters wanted to go in another direction, and they decide to go in another direction themselves, move on, retire. And so decisions about running again after having been not successfully re-elected are more common for, all sorts of, I would say, practical reasons. But in the case of former President Trump, he still remains wildly popular amongst the base of the Republican Party. I think that there's growing discontent amongst some in the Republican Party, but consistently there's enough in the Republican Party that is showing its support for him, that not just support for him, but for the kind of policies he's talking about. And I know that that's causing a lot of consternation amongst other Republicans.
I want to talk about the idea of negative partisanship a little bit. The idea that, yes, there's a core who are very pro their party, Republican or Democrat, but it seems like there's a growing number of Americans who maybe they don't identify with this party, but they very much identify as against that party or maybe against that party's candidate. Is this something you're seeing? How big a factor is that as we move through a presidential campaign?
I mean, I think that we're seeing it, like you said, more and more at the state level and also nationally, and not just in Wisconsin, but across the country. And when you look at some of the polling in regard to, and you alluded to this earlier, the number of people who don't want candidates to run, some of that's within the party, but for others, it's looking at the opposing party. And I think that a lot of this is not at all surprising, given just the negativity and hyper-partisanship that we're seeing. I mean, thinking back historically, when the parties weren't as polarized, and you had moderate Republicans and conservative Democrats. There was just so much more overlap that, or crossover, that you didn't have so much polarization. And I think that this makes part of the reason why we're seeing this negative partisanship.
One issue I want to talk about is abortion. We're in the post-Roe versus Wade world now. We've seen it have some impact, I think it's fair to say, on elections. It's not the only issue that we've seen in elections so far. A lot of voters seem concerned about it. A lot of Republican states moving toward more stringent abortion restrictions. How important do you see this being in a presidential race in 2024?
Yeah, I mean, I think that it's going to be a major issue. And we've seen that in Wisconsin. We've seen that in elections across the country for different offices. And so I think that this is an issue that, again, that non-Trump supporting wing of the Republican Party is really wishing would go away, but it's not going away. And instead, we see almost weekly state legislatures across the country in Republican states introducing new and more restrictive legislation in the face of strong support in the other direction.
We're talking to UW-Whitewater Associate Professor of Political Science, Susan Johnson, looking ahead at the race for president, the possibility of another Biden-Trump general election. Asterisk, there's still a long time to go. We don't know if that's how it will turn out. You could join in at 800-642-1234. If you lean toward Democrats, do you want to see President Biden running for a second term? If you lean Republican, same question about former President Trump. And if not them, then who? Call 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234. We'll pick up the conversation coming up on Central Time. This is Central Time. I'm Rob Barrett. We're talking to UW-Whitewater Associate Professor of Political Science, Susan Johnson, about the campaign for president. Yeah, it's going on already. And what a Trump-Biden rematch might look like, what the alternatives might be. You can join in at 800-642-1234. Let's go to your calls now. Chris is with us in Black River Falls. Hi, Chris.
Hi. So my first question is, you know, I wonder if people would maybe see Biden more favorably if he was to choose a different running mate, perhaps. I don't know if that would change the dynamic there. Secondly, on the Republican side, or on the right side, I guess, if you will, I see Mr. Trump's politics as a existential threat to the United States, and I just can't see how he could be electable. I think it's just such divisive politics with Mr. Trump. At least with Biden, we kind of know a consistent direction that we're going. We know what the politics is.
Chris, thanks a lot for the call. Let's take each of those points in turn, Susan. First of all, the idea of President Biden changing running mates, from what I understand from their announcement, that's not the plan. They're going to stick with that ticket.
Right. And one of the reasons why I think Chris might be asking the question is because Kamala Harris's numbers, her approval ratings or whatever, favorability ratings are lower than President Biden's. And so there has been talk about potentially if there was a different running mate, would that make a difference? From a practical political perspective, President Biden can't replace Kamala Harris on the ticket. It just would, I would say it would harm his reelectability, particularly in the fact that it might get people who would otherwise vote, just not vote. I mean, those people would not vote Republican, people who would be, you know, terribly upset, but they would probably not vote. So that could be an issue. And there has been no talk. When he came out yesterday with his announcement, Tuesday, it was with the understanding that she was going to be his running mate. But Chris is not the only person to be wondering that same thing.
And then Chris brings up the unique nature of former President Trump. It's a president who's had a 6-week campaign to try to overturn the outcome of the 2020 election, culminating in January 6th. Chris says an existential threat to U.S. democracy.
You know, I think there's a lot of Republicans who are feeling the same way. Perhaps they're not calling him an existential threat, but they're arguing that he's not electable for some of the reasons that Chris mentioned. I would say also that in some of the stuff I've been looking at, polling data and the like, yes, both Trump and Biden have high, you know, please don't run. But when you look at who would be more likely to win, it's pretty clearly Biden. And that suggests to me that there are amongst those people who say, please don't run, the please don't run group on the Republican side are the ones that are feeling it a bit more than people on the Democratic side who might just be, you know, thinking maybe Biden's a little bit too old or not liberal enough. But they're much more likely, I would say, to vote for Biden at the end of the day than some of the people in the Republican Party who are just totally anti-Trump.
Thanks for the call, Chris. Jeff joins us now in Pittsville. Jeff, hi.
Hello. My comment is the fact that I think that former President Trump is so divisive, whereas President Biden is more of a uniter. And that's the bottom line. I think that there's definitely problems with the divisiveness of the whole country.
Jeff, thanks for the call. And that's a word that I think comes up often with former President Trump, Susan, divisiveness. What do you think it might take if he ends up being the Republican nominee? Again, we don't know that'll happen, for him to reach out to maybe independents who might share Jeff's concerns.
I don't think he has an interest in reaching out to people who share that concern. And I think that, again, that's a concern of many people in the Republican Party who are looking at the possibility of losing in the presidential election. I mean, I think that's just it. His brand is divisive, and so I don't see that changing.
Jeff, thanks a lot for that call. As we wrap up, Susan, I always wonder what you are talking to your students about as we approach a big event like a presidential race. Do your students have your eyes that far ahead yet, or is there something you have on the shorter time horizon right now, apart from exams?
Yeah, I mean, I don't think so. I think that there was a lot of engagement around here on the Supreme Court race in Wisconsin, which is unique, and I think that's really exciting. But I think that there's just not as many of us as maybe we'd like who are already thinking ahead that far.
I kind of envy people who aren't thinking ahead that far in some ways. But here we are. Susan, thanks so much for joining us again. Always good to talk to you.
Yeah, same here. Thanks, Rob.
That's Susan Johnson, Associate Professor of Political Science at the University of Wisconsin-Whitewater. She joined us for a look ahead at the 2024 presidential campaign. Coming up, the fastest growing category of books last year was romance novels. An expert on the genre tells us why readers can't put them down and why romance books deserve more respect. This is Central Time. I'm Rob Ferret. In the ever-changing landscape of the book industry, one genre is standing out as the fastest growing in fiction, particularly among young adult readers. Romance novels were the highest-selling genre of fiction in 2022, with the research company Circana reporting 19 million units sold just through August of last year. That followed a strong 2021, and the genre is seeing a two-year high in overall growth. Analysts say stores are dedicating more shelf space to romance, and the social media app TikTok may be helping the genre reach new, younger audiences. We're visiting the world of romance novels to learn why readers are having a love affair with the books. Jessica Van Sloten is the Dean of Arts and Sciences at Bay College in the Upper Peninsula of Michigan. Her research focuses on teaching and learning, and she also is a scholar of popular romance fiction. She formerly taught at UW-Green Bay, where she gave a TEDx talk entitled Romance Novels Are Feminist. Jessica, welcome to Central Time.
Thank you for having me, Rob. It's great to be here.
How do we define the romance genre? You know, a lot of books will have a love angle to them. What is it that makes something a romance novel?
Yes, that's a great question to start us off with, because often there's a lot of confusion about how to qualify something as a romance. So there's basically two essential elements that mark something as romance. It needs to have a central love story, so that needs to be the main focus, and it needs to have what the Romance Writers of America call an emotionally satisfying and optimistic ending.
Now, romance novels are selling great, but they sometimes don't get a lot of respect, it seems like, for a couple reasons. I think some people just look down on them as, maybe formulaic or cliche on one hand. And then something I know you've talked about, including in that TEDx talk I mentioned, is that from a feminist angle, people say, well, is this really a great message? You, I think, are defending romance novels these days from both of those concerns. Make your case.
Yeah, so I think they have been historically maligned since the beginning. It was fiction that was primarily associated with women, and there was a lot of skepticism around that and around things that women like. And as the genre has kind of expanded, where I see the promise is that it's giving messages of hope and possibility to all kinds of people to be loved for who they are. We see a big rise in representation of LGBTQ folks in romance novels, in people of color in romance novels, and so that's where I see the potential and the celebration of joy rather than only oppression, right? So those are some of the ways that I personally embrace the genre, and I know some of my fellow readers do as well.
In addition to having just a more diverse array of characters and maybe authors, are there other ways in which you've seen romance novels change over the years?
Yeah, I think there's been a transformation, particularly of the biggest genre convention that people like to think about, the ending, right? That historically romance novels ended in marriage. If you think of Jane Austen's classic novels as romance, they always end with, the couple getting married, what we call the happily ever after. And over time, that really transformed into what we call a happily for now, right? There's more of a temporariness sometimes to those endings, and what that happy ending looks like is going to be different. And so I think that's something that's interesting. We also see a change in the voice, right? It was really popular for a long time to have alternate voices. So if you had a traditional heterosexual romance, you would have one chapter from the male perspective, the next from the female, back and forth. And in the last couple of years, we've seen a rise in single point of view romance novels.
Now, we've seen pretty good sales numbers, as I was saying at the beginning, and some thought at any way that that younger people, young adults, are driving some of those increases. What do you see as the appeal of the modern romance novel to younger readers?
Yeah, I think it's fascinating to think about how this rise parallels both the rise of first Bookstagram, which is sort of people my generation, Gen X, gravitated towards that social media, and younger generations transforming that into BookTok, right? So on TikTok, as well as the pandemic, right? And just the influence that had on people's habits of consumption of media and the kinds of stories that they were looking for. And what romance provides with us is hope and possibility, a place where characters are loved for who they truly are, and vulnerability, as well as some interesting rise in a kind of dark romance subgenre. So I think, getting at the uncertain times that we've lived in, and romance gives us a nice container that we know things are going to end well in the end of the book, even if it's turbulent throughout. So I think those couple of threads are important. And the third one I would mention is the rise in sort of a parasocial relationship, the ways that consumers of media can be connected to the creators of media through social media, right? They can follow their favorite authors on TikTok and Instagram and feel like they're having a relationship with them, right? And so there's a closeness that's very exciting and appealing for readers.
Talking to Jessica Van Sloten with Bay College in the UP in Michigan, looking at romance novels, a big boost in popularity lately, and they've changed over the years too. Now, that talk I mentioned you did at UW Green Bay a couple few years ago, looking at seeing romance novels as feminist and not just as some people have criticized, reinforcing gender norms. Can you give us a Cliff's Notes version of what were you, the case you were making there?
Sure. I think the case I made in that TED talk was that we really see these stories that are places of positivity and a way for people to work out their relationships to power. So a scholar I really admire, Catherine Roach, thinks that romance novels give folks who don't have as much power, traditionally women or maybe LGBTQ folks, ways of leveling the playing field through romantic relationships, right? So, you know, if you think about your typical romance storyline, there's conflict, but in the end, there's happiness and usually some kind of egalitarianism. And so that's one thread that I think makes them a potentially feminist genre.
I'm a science fiction reader. That's kind of my genre. And there's some works where I'll, you know, defend the writing and the innovation and things like that. And they're awesome. And there's some that are, you know, kind of cliche and formulaic, but I still kind of like them anyway, because it's my kind of thing. Do you see that kind of variation as well within the romance novel genre?
Yes, definitely. Right. And as thinking about coming on the air today, I'm thinking there's whole subgenres that I just don't read, right? For one reason or another, they're just not something that I'm drawn to. And that as someone who has a literary background too, I'm really interested in the quality of the writing and the craft of the plot, right? And there is a lot of variation. And I think the most important thing is that people are finding stories that resonate with them. And for each reader, that's going to be a little bit different. And romance is such a big tent that there's something for everyone. And the rise of self-publishing has allowed more people to write stories and get them in front of readers. And I think that's a powerful other component of this rise in popularity.
Now, if somebody's listening and thinking, okay, yeah, I'm a reader. Maybe you've got me almost persuaded with this romance novel thing to check it out. Where you can name names if you want here, Jessica, where would you steer them to start? Like, what would be a good entry point or author or subgenre or whatever that new romance novel reader could open the door with?
Yeah, I'd like to tell you about a book I'm reading right now. Okay. I haven't finished it, but I know it's going to have a happy ending because that's the promise of the genre. But it's by an author named Adriana Herrera. And it's called A Caribbean Heiress in Paris. And it's a historical romance. So if there's any fans out there of Bridgerton, for example, this might be for you. It's set in 1899 Paris World's Exposition. And she does a lot of really clever things in updating a historical romance in that she has characters of color, characters, you know, from the Caribbean islands who have envisioned a way to produce liquor, not relying on slave labor, right? And so she's really making some interesting statements and really transforming and modernizing the genre and doing it in a historical time setting, which I think is pretty cool.
Now, a personal example for me, I grew up thinking, you know, Jane Austen, you mentioned earlier, you know, I'm a guy and that's mostly written for women. So I never touched it. I didn't consciously avoid it. And then I started reading Jane Austen. And I'm like, this is really good. And I read more and more. Can you make the case to the guys like me out there who might think romance novels, they're just not for me to begin with?
Yeah, I think one interesting way to think about it is that Jane Austen was writing what we might call domestic fiction, right? And male authors have written that over time, right? Maybe the narratives have had a different arc or they've prioritized things other than the love relationship. But, you know, even if someone is, say, a Jonathan Franzen fan, right? He writes these complex families and relationships, right? So I would say that someone could pick up a romance novel and find some interest and satisfaction. And actually, there's a great author, Lissa K. Adams, writes these bromance book club series, and it's about a group of men who read romance novels in order to have better relationships. So, and they're pro athletes who are in this club that read together. So there's a lot of interesting entry points for readers of all genders.
Jessica, we'll leave it there. Thanks a lot for joining us today.
Thank you so much.
That's Jessica Van Sloten, Dean of Arts and Sciences and a scholar of popular romance fiction at Bay College in Michigan's UP. She was with us today to look at the rising popularity of romance novels and how the genre has changed over time.